And now we are attempting down to say that with basically a car to turn back and it's now we are attempting down to say that with the moment in car to and it's now now what but it's said the moment in car that it's what we're headed to, and it's because we are not 100%, but it's said there are people struggling to figure out how to balance the relationship. There are
cultures are melted down in the belly of the Western scientific beast, and then they become
Well, hello out there, ladies and gents. This is Web Madman here for another week of Art Space Noise Space. In the background, you're hearing some Full Metal Booty playing away, our local noise band that gets together about once a week down at Art Space. And we try to explore brave new sound worlds. What I'm doing on this show is maybe talking about it a little bit and putting it into context. One of the things to keep in mind when you're participating in a noise band or project is to remember to listen. Listening is probably one of the most important parts because while you're making your own sound, you need to listen to what the other people making sound is doing and sort of respond and synchronize and dance around each other in that auditory space. So that's one of the key things to keep in mind. Now, I've got Pilot K9. Sitting here next to me.
I got no adapter for my headphones, so
well, I'll try to keep.
I can't hear what's going on in the background.
Right. Well, I've got it fairly low, and it's from what I can hear, there's John doing some of his strange vocals.
Right.
Nader doing some drumming, and the odd bit of noodling coming in from Stu.
All of whom are no longer playing with us.
At this point, then again, who knows? Maybe we can entice them back into the fold in the long stretch of time. Who knows?
We'll see.
We'll see. That said, we would certainly like to invite other people to sort of join in when and if they can.
Yeah, to play sound, to sing, to dance.
Yep. And we've also had many nights where people have showed up doing projections and other things of that nature as well.
That's fun. Yeah, Chad doesn't do that anymore. He's too busy with the Sapphire.
Right. But I remember way back when I first joined Full Metal Booty, you and your partner Carrie would do slide projections on a regular basis.
Yeah, well, I don't have room to store all those projectors at ArtSpace anymore.
Yeah, well, and the other thing too, and this is the downside of using slide projectors, is the bulbs, which of course are...
Oh my God, $50 a piece.
Yeah, yeah, and so regular usage tends to be kind of expensive.
Well, the place I usually get bulbs is I go around to yard sales.
Right.
Find projectors that are a bit wonky, but they're $5 or $3 or whatever.
Yep.
And buy them and use the bulb.
Right. Yep. Which, although I'm having the feeling that with the slide projectors, I mean, there's less and less of them in use, so...
The era is coming to an end.
Yeah. So I guess it's going to be time to get yourself a data projector, huh?
Soon enough.
Yep. Well, and on that front, I think that you've got an exceptional archive of photographs and images digitally.
I really would like to... I put my digital photos on a rotating slideshow, the window slideshow.
Yep.
There's got to be some way to slow that down, but I couldn't figure it out. But to do crossfading.
Yeah.
I want to work with Lester's equipment.
Right.
Sometime when there's a big secret show at ArtSpace.
Right.
Because what I've been doing is taking my photos and using a free download to morph one into the other.
Right.
And stretch them and squeeze them and do things to them.
Right.
And if I loop that, I can get these pulses.
Right.
And actually pretty creepy looking stuff.
Yeah.
So if I save these as some compressed video format, then I can mix two of these sequences at once, crossfade them.
Crossfading them, and well, the other thing with Lester's software-hardware combination is that it's got some incredible effects for overlaying, as well as the crossfade.
Cutting up the image, reassembling it, distorting it into a sphere or a tunnel.
Yep. Which, of course, is completely conducive to the complement the soundscapes that are created. One of the neat things with the actual physical surface that Lester has for his VJ equipment is that it's like playing live. There's, you know, your hand is in the mix. It's not like pre-editing something and then showing it.
No, well, you've got like little basically DJ, not quite scratch pads, but what are they called? They're on this new CD player as well.
Right.
What are those knobs called though?
Good question.
Jog wheel.
That's probably in the ballpark, because that's exactly what it is, where you're... Right. Yeah.
So you can shake the image back and forth.
Yeah.
And in effect, scratch it.
Yep.
Back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
Making it run backwards is always fun.
Yep. Yeah. Speed it up. Slow it down. Oh, Hartley has started chiming in the background, who, of course, right now is he's, like you, one of the founding members and one of the longest-standing members of Full Metal Booty, which is very cool. I think that you and Hartley, in some ways, have somewhat of the soul. The soul
it
of
could
the
be.
Booty. You just don't want to take responsibility, do you?
Not really.
But I was mentioning about the importance of listening in doing noise jams. And,
this was a problem when we let people come in and, you know, we invited people to come and jam with us.
Because
when we started, we were just making noise.
Right.
Like, we didn't have any plan.
Right.
Or any skills or anything.
Right.
But it wasn't long. It was a matter of a couple of months before we realized that we were listening to each other and responding to each other.
Mm-hmm.
But people would come in, especially people who wanted to play Stu's guitar,
right?
Which was another sore point.
Yeah.
But people would find that they heard nothing familiar.
Right.
Nothing that they could identify or understand. Mm-hmm. So they assumed that anything goes.
Yeah.
And that we just don't care.
Right. Yeah.
So they would wail away.
Yeah.
Complete abandon.
Yep.
And not listen to us.
Yeah. Which would, you know, elicit from us sort of the response of, you know, either trying to overpower them.
That was fun.
That was fun. Which I think is one of the reasons that Full Metal Booty started to get a reputation of being very, very loud. Because the volume levels would just slowly climb through the roof.
Well, this was in the early days when our space was still on Hunter Street.
Yeah.
Beside St. Veronis.
Yeah.
St. Veronis actually expanded into the old art space.
Right.
And it was really funny because we were sitting in the office one day.
Yeah.
And these two guys from Veronis come over.
Yeah.
And they got tape measures, and they start measuring the walls. And Dave says,
what you doing?
Can we help you? No, we're fine.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they had made a deal with the landlord.
Right.
To take over art space.
Right.
The landlord had assumed that we were going to move out at any time because we were renting month to month.
Right.
Had no lease.
Right.
So then we had to go.
Right. Although, I mean, in retrospective, of course, it was probably one of the best things because it led to art space being able to expand and move into the space we're in now, where we can offer a great deal more.
Well, yeah, but that was a long process.
I know.
With a lot of loss in between.
Yes, a this flood.
It was almost 5 years ago that we moved under the Wolf on King Street.
Yeah.
And when the flood came, late, I guess, August of 2004, well, there was so much water. There was 6 inches of water in the business above art space.
Yeah. It was a big laundry machine, washing machine in the basement full of lovely sewage.
It was incredible, though. I figured that, you know, the water had seeped in. It had come up through the toilet pipes and everything.
Right.
And the insurance guys and the building inspectors and everyone was down there with their white Tyvek coveralls and booties. And I wanted to see what was going on down there.
Yeah.
Dave and I both, so we sneaked down.
Yeah.
They made us leave, but we did get to take a look around.
Yeah.
And I'd kind of assumed that the water had covered everything, but when the water was pumped out, which took, a day and a half?
Yeah, it was a long...
2 days?
Yeah, it was probably closer to 2 days.
A couple of days.
Yeah.
And stuff, it looked like a bomb had gone off there.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, because I think that the force of the water coming in off the street, because we were below ground level, it was a raging river.
I wish I'd seen it from a safe vantage point.
Yeah.
But, that was quite a torrent.
Yeah.
And, what happened to my bike? I left my bike locked up to a tree cage on the street.
Yeah.
I got there the next day.
Yeah.
No bike, no tree cage.
Ah.
The whole thing had
gone
sailed
off.
Down into Little Lake.
Well, it was interesting because getting back to, I mean, we were excited as art space, moving into that space, because it was much larger than the space we had at St. Veronis. It was going to allow us to do a great deal more. As an artist-run center, and it was quite exciting. And also,
we moved in with the PAU.
Yep. And that was, the beginnings of, sort of like the first draft of the situation we're in now, where we've got this, the building, 378 Aylmer, that's the address, right?
Yeah.
which has the PAU, art space, but now it's got a number of other organizations in there as well. So, I mean... as time unfolds, if you take advantage, it's fortunate that we've been able to get into a nice space.
Well, yeah, not just survive, but...
Thrive.
Thrive.
Yeah, exactly. Coming back around to, we do now have the mudroom in the back.
Right. can be an alternative performance space, a projection space, like to view videos.
Yeah, which the Trent Film Society has been taking advantage of.
Yes. Are they doing half of their films at ArtSpace and half at Sadler House?
I think that's it. I couldn't say for sure, but I've noticed that, yeah,
it seems to alternate. That's what they did last year.
Yeah, which is great. It allows us to offer a space to bring people together around culture. Mm-hmm. And it's also where Full Metal Booty is sort of in residence.
Yeah, me and my stuff. My stuff has been a running joke ever since we moved into that location.
Right.
I've still got a lot of stuff there. I've got a huge duffel bag full of percussion gear.
Right.
I got a broken photocopier that I don't really want to talk about. I think I want to try and get it out of there this weekend if I can.
Right. Well, and this is coming around to you when folks come out to a Full Metal Booty show, I say in quotes. That's when we're able to pull out your little box of toys and
the noise toys,
which is great because I think that the key with this noise stuff is that it is somewhat of a participatory thing, and it's probably the best enjoyed when you're engaged in it, and that includes what we've been talking about, how important it is to listen. So.
Yeah. You'll get it a lot more if you're playing along than if you're just listening, sitting there.
Yeah, and I think that that's part of the flavor of the project is that it's participatory rather than simply spectator.
Yeah.
I think for me anyway, that's the value of it is.
I want the dancers back.
Yeah. No. And that's part of it is that it's conducive to this kind of free form open space for exploration of any medium or media that you care to bring to the table.
Yeah. Well, I've been meaning to do this for some time, and I just never get around to writing out a proposal or a structure for this.
Right.
But to workshop dancers and slide projectors.
Yep.
And not just projecting a background onto a wall.
Right.
But multiple projectors from in different locations.
Angles. Yep.
So that if the dancers, as they dance through the beams of the different projectors, they'll cast different colored shadows in different places.
Yep.
Projectors that we can carry around and... one time when I was doing light shows for the Subtonic Monks, a band in Toronto, and we went up, they set up on the street with drums and their acoustic instruments to try and entice some people in.
Mm-hmm.
So I got an extension cord, and I ran up on the roof of the National Arts Center and projected up and down the sidewalk.
Wow. That's cool.
It was a lot of fun. It got people's attention.
Yep. Yep. No, and I mean, and this is the sort of thing where it's coming around to some of the political issues going on right now in terms of arts and culture and how, you know, I think that as artists, what we're trying to do is create spaces.
Yeah.
In terms of that, a lot of people say like, well, you know, if art is good, then it should be commercially viable. And in this type of a situation, it's
no, that's not the point.
That's not the point, exactly. But at the same time, I think that it does contribute a great deal. That I know myself with Full Metal Booty, there's a lot of people that have come through that have really appreciated having the opportunity to experience something like that.
Ordinary Canadians,
exactly. And I think that it's something that we would like to expand upon and keep moving with, and particularly in getting people to know what it is and see what it is. And,
if something is going to be participatory, you can hardly expect it to be commercially viable.
No, exactly. I mean,
it's improvised and it's like a bit messy and ragged at the edges.
Yep. And as we've talked about, it's not something that is very conducive to a spectator sort of consumption.
Right.
And I think that that's one of the keys is that for something to be commercially viable, it almost necessarily falls into a more spectator or spectacle.
Yeah, yeah.
Where there's a definite line between performer and audience, because that's the only way you can charge for it on that commercial way of doing things.
Right.
So,
well, the monks, subtonic monks, for instance, they had a series of subtonic cycles, they were called.
Right.
Built by an artist named Phil Sarrazin, who, he built the weirdest bicycles that took three or four people to pedal. They looked like Dr. Seuss meets the Road Warrior, kind of bright colors, spinning. They were covered with drums.
Yeah.
And when they went down the street, like in the Pride Parade, people could walk out from the sidewalk and start playing, jamming
drums.
Away on the drums.
Nice.
They've also got, they especially liked playing for kids.
Yeah.
And they had the noise-making toys, or I called it the monk junk, that they could hand out to everyone.
Right.
And the simplest thing was just empty water bottles filled with rice.
Oh, shakers. Shakers, yep.
Hand them out to the whole audience.
Right, right. Wow. Wow, that would be quite a sound, actually.
There was another great sound they had, this giant singing bowl.
Oh,
it wasn't specifically made as a singing bowl. It was a salad bowl.
Right.
But it was glass.
Yeah.
And with a rubber-tipped mallet running it around the edge, you could make it vibrate and sing.
Nice.
And it drove sound guys crazy because it always sounded like slowly building feedback.
Yep. That's funny. Now, you've been mentioning the subtonic monks, and I'm just sort of curious as to what's the background of them.
Well, I met them at when I was at the Ontario College of Art.
Mm-hmm.
One member was a student.
Mm-hmm.
Another guy was a student at U of T.
Uh huh.
And there were other artists like Phil Sarrazin.
Yeah.
Who I'd met previously.
Mm-hmm.
They did a pretty theatrical show.
Yeah.
For one thing, they had a huge screen of spandex, white spandex. And Peter Jarvis would get behind it and press his way out, his hands in his face.
Right.
And it would be this creepy three-dimensional thing.
Yep.
And one night when there was a really sparse crowd, I was set up two projectors at 45 degree angles to the screen.
Right.
With a predominantly red slide in one and blue in the other. Although they were like pictures of one was a sea urchin and one was an island in the ocean.
Right.
But when they're coming at the at the screen, at this angle, and the screen is pushed out, it casts a shadow in the color complementary to the slide.
Yep.
And that made a pretty intricate and interesting visual show.
That would be really interesting to look at with those. What are they? Anaglyphic? The red blue 3D glasses.
Yeah.
Because it would be 3D. Ooh. Does that mean you'd get into the fourth dimension?
It's worth a try. I think the musical would often take us there.
Yeah.
They also worked with dancers a lot.
Yeah.
And there could be as many as 15 people on stage playing at once.
Wow.
They also had these spandex cubes.
Right. You see, now that's something that I do remember seeing a number of years ago, and it was, what's that guy? He was on CBC. He's done a lot of CBC radio. Ralph Benmerghi.
Yeah.
And I don't know who it was. But he had this regular guest who was in one of these spandex cubes doing some of the most outrageous, crazy stuff. And as you say, very creepy looking.
Yeah. Because the cube, it's covered with spandex all the way around.
Mm-hmm.
And the flap that overlaps, and you have to climb inside it. It looks quite awkward.
Yeah.
But it's just a plastic frame inside. And you can shuffle around and just move around the floor without any visible means of support.
Right.
Just
wow.
Slide across the stage. Or they could tip up on one edge.
Yeah.
Since it was a person inside balancing it, it could stay on its edge.
Right.
Or even on its point.
Right.
And move it. That was a very weird thing to see.
Yeah.
Three of them.
Yeah. And has it struck me as looking very computer generated. Like, even though it was very physical, it had this, you know, strangely, you know, kind of CGI sensibility to it.
Well, it was really brightly colored spandex, too. Yep. That helped.
Yeah, yeah.
Made it look a little bit unreal.
Yeah, yeah, no, exactly. And, I mean, I was, as I said, watching it on television, which, you know, sort of the way it's filmed and everything, I think that it ends up looking very, as you say, creepy.
creepy but fun, too.
Creepy but fun, yes. But yeah, and I think that this is where, in some ways, using the phrase noise band can be a little bit misleading. Because, yeah, at the core of it is making a lot of auditory stuff. But I think that we're, at the same time, trying to create a framework that allows a lot of other things to be integrated.
Well, I guess I thought fairly early on that we were more sophisticated than a noise band.
Right.
Although, you know, that's not necessarily true. I mean, there are people who've studied, they're like scientists of noise.
Yep.
Like Mertzbau.
Yeah. Yes.
But we're getting into, for one thing, the improvisation and the interaction between us. We have to be a little bit more quiet.
Yep.
So we can pay attention.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and I think one of the other things is, and we've discussed this before, that in differentiating with something like the Nihilist Spasm Band, who actually do have, they're not set pieces, but there's certain sort of underlying structures that they're using.
Well, the vocals.
Yeah.
Are the.
Yeah.
They said they have only like 17 songs or something.
Right. Which continually mutate and change.
They're different every time.
Yeah. But I think that with Full Metal Booty, we've been, you know, right from the get-go sort of saying, like, no, we're going to, you know, every time we do this, it's going to be completely different.
Yeah.
And I think that that's, you know, a particular flavor of the project that we're doing. Now, we talked before about how we would do games, though.
We haven't done those for a while, and I'd kind of like to do that again.
Yeah, I think part of it is that right now we've only got the three core
members.
Yeah, that are that have been with it long enough to really be able to, because it takes a certain amount of skill, and familiarity with what the other people are doing in order to do that. Because, we would do the duets game where one person would start and they would cue the person that would join them. And
they would cue the next person.
Yep. And it would just continually be, you know, mainly duets with a slight overlap in between. And eventually,
everyone would play with everyone.
Yeah. And eventually everyone would start, you know, jumping in and it would go into a full-on booty session. But that would also be quite interesting because it would, depending on how the duets developed, would really determine the flavor of the jam. Which was, again, like, I think that this is where it's like we can pull things in that add dimension without necessarily adding a structure per se. To the actual what sounds we're producing. It's not like, okay, let's do this in A.
Well, you could almost say that we have temporary structures that evolve, but they change into something else. I mean, they come together pretty much spontaneously.
Yeah.
Just by paying attention to what somebody else is doing and responding.
Yeah.
That sets up a little bit of a structure.
Yep. Well, and one of the things that we've commented on as well is that we can tell we're in sync because there's pauses where all of the sound sort of comes to these sort of conclusions and then there's a pause and then a start into something else.
Yeah. When we were in the downstairs, the King Street location, we played later than, well, there was nobody living upstairs.
Yeah, so we could go very, very late.
And we got to really intense.
Yeah.
Our second jam, usually, would be like an play like mad for an hour.
Yeah.
But we'd all stop at the
same time. Yeah. No, it was great. And just as a side note, we were actually in the space the night before the flood. And David Lerviere, who at the time was the director of ArtSpace and definitely a major part of the Full Metal Booty at the time, we were there until about two or three. And it was only a few hours later that the flood hit. So, yeah.
Well, I stood there on the steps looking at the rain. I didn't want to bike home.
Right.
It looked terrible. I took my digital effects back downstairs where they'd be safe. I sat there wondering what to do. Luckily, someone was coming home from the media lab and offered me a ride home.
Right.
And I was soaking wet, like to the skin, just from crossing the street.
Yeah.
The rain was so intense.
Yeah.
And Dave was still there.
Yeah.
So the next day when I saw what had happened to Art Space, I thought, wow.
Whoa, where's Dave?
Where's Dave?
Yeah.
He's not answering his phone.
But fortunately, there was, because that would have been a very tricky situation, because it did happen very, very quickly.
He would have died if he'd been in there.
Yeah, yeah. Or had to have been really quick on his feet to figure out a way out of there.
Yeah.
Depending on, yeah. But yeah, pretty spooky. because fortunately, there were no casualties in the flood, as far as I remember.
Yeah, it's amazing, the extent of that flood.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I think that ArtSpace was in a particularly devastated place.
Right.
I'm not sure how many other places actually got that devastated.
I saw some houses in the South End.
Yeah.
My mom was away out of town at the time, so I thought I'd better go check out her house.
Right.
And it looked fine, like the streets looked pretty okay, the closer I got. And then all of a sudden I turned onto her street, and it was like devastation.
Wow.
The people had been really busy that day, and the streets were covered with broken washing machines and fridges and whatever else, projection TVs.
Right. Well, I guess that's where the everything that got like washed away ended up down there, right?
Yeah.
Did you find your bike in the tree cage down there?
No. Afraid not.
Well, because I know that the Grassroots, they had a patio at the time that went swimming down the street.
That's great. Yeah, it took out a cop car along the way. Those darn anarchists.
Those darn anarchists, yeah.
And then it grounded itself outside the library.
Oh, yeah.
And there was a pint glass still standing up on one of the tables.
Oh, man. That's like a magic trick, eh?
Uh-huh.
That's funny. So, coming around to you, are still doing Tuesday nights?
I am, yeah.
Yeah.
Tuesday from 10 till midnight.
Mm-hmm.
I do a show called Praying Mantra.
Right. Now, what is the difference in flavor? Just to sort of, you know, do you use different sources? Is there a different sensibility involved?
Yeah, both.
Yeah?
I use a collection of sources, often little tiny bits of rhythms from music from Romania or Indonesia or whatever.
Right.
I'm looking for interesting sounding instruments, odd rhythms.
Yeah.
I make loops of them at home. I make samples.
Mm-hmm.
And then I run them here using, in general, five sources.
Okay.
That is three copies of Winamp, the media player on the computer, which we're not using today.
Right.
And two CD players.
Right.
And there's also the logger, which records everything that's broadcast.
Yeah.
It comes back into the board.
Yeah.
Like, you can fade it up in the board, and it gives about a 30-second delay.
Right.
So everything that goes out gets echoed and echoed over and over again.
Yep. A deteriorating loop.
yeah, I can build up pretty dense things.
Yeah.
And even bring down all the other sources.
Right.
And leave the thing just feeding back to itself.
Right. Now, how would that contrast with, say, Dog Bites Manlisher?
Well, that's a collaboration.
Yeah.
That started out as Jam with Manlisher with Michael Waterman.
Right.
Also an early member of Full Metal Booty.
Mm-hmm.
He would get his two partners in Manlisher Carcano would call him up on the phone from Winnipeg and L.A. and their audio contributions would come into the station.
Yeah.
And Michael or Porter Hall would mix them.
Yeah.
Add his own.
Yeah.
And send it out over the airwaves.
Right.
When he went to Guelph for graduate studies, or postgraduate, he got himself a radio show there.
Right.
And we decided that I would take over his time slot here in Peterborough.
Yeah.
And he would get the same time slot at CFRU in Guelph.
Mm-hmm.
And then, since both stations were streaming and available over the internet, we could tune each other in. Just, you know, add more to the network.
Right. So, and in that case, you're still using some of the same sources and stuff. Although, I do notice that you tend to use a lot more spoken word stuff.
A lot of spoken word, and especially since we've got these new CD players here.
Right.
Because you can do loops.
Uh-huh.
I love that function.
Uh-huh. And speed control.
Yes.
Yeah, so the combination of looping and speed control. Woo!
Yeah, that's actually for made more for beat matching for DJs.
Right.
But, I don't care.
You marched your own beat. Cool. I guess, we've still got some stuff actually rolling around in there. But as I was coming into this show, you had some Terrence McKenna going. And it was kind of interesting, the little bits that would bobble up and bounce around.
Right. You can't hear the whole speech or understand it all.
Yeah.
But the parts that do come through.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is kind of a dislocating experience,
yep.
Especially if I've got a couple of lectures going.
Yeah. Well, and this is where it's similar to the Burroughs cut-up stuff, and particularly when Burroughs was using a lot of audio tape to do cut-ups. It's kind of like a progression of that technique.
Yeah, Burroughs audio tape is now at Scotland Yard.
Oh, yeah?
he gave all his old audio tape to Genesis Peorage.
who got busted in the Thatcher era for being, what is it, a wrecker
for
of...
For being weird.
Yeah, for being a wrecker of civilizations. Wasn't that what he was called in Parliament? Yeah.
Something like that. Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's not unjust, but at the same time, it's like, what civilization is he wrecking?
Mm-hmm.
And does it deserve to be wrecked?
Portions of it.
Portions of
certainly.
It.
Certainly.
Because at this point, he's doing some very interesting stuff in terms of challenging gender and that sort of stuff. He's got his whole pandemonium sort of...
Right.
Thing going on right now where him and his wife got matching breast implants and, you know, he dresses in a distinctly sort of androgynous way where he looks like a demented secretary.
Yeah. Or if not androgynous, then pandrogynous.
Pandrogynous.
Which is a word that I think he probably made up.
That's the word I was looking for, actually.
Yeah.
That's, yeah. Because, yes, Pandemonium is one of the tracks, I think, off of Heaven is Here, Hell is Nowhere, or something like that? Anyway.
Was that the last Psychic TV album?
Yeah, yeah. Which, unfortunately, when they were about to do their European tour, his wife passed away. Which is quite tragic.
That was the end of that project.
That was the end of that project, which, I mean, he's now reinventing in a whole new way, which, of course, he's one of those types of people where, like when he got run out of the UK and came over to the US and started going stronger than ever.
Yeah. Should have moved to Toronto instead of New York, though.
Yeah. Well, he did eventually get down to California because Timothy Leary really helped him out. And there was a whole connection there for a while.
Yeah, and now apparently he's allowed back into Britain.
Right. Well, you know, change of government.
Well, he was told at the time of the bust, he was they busted his house, but he was out of the country.
Yeah.
And his house got vandalized and they some friends, I guess, rescued a bit of their art collection and their archives.
Right.
But... when he contacted Scotland Yard to find out what was going on, they said, if you choose to return, we cannot guarantee your safety.
Huh. Jeez. And who exactly is the civilized part in all of this? Well, because I was going to say, though, coming back to the Burroughs cut-up stuff and how one of the things that's interesting with those types of experiments is the juxtapositions that come out. And
how they seem to make sense and seem to refer to other events.
Yes.
Or even future events.
Yeah. It was in particular, back when I first started reading Burroughs, I started to get to the point where, in reading some of that stuff, particularly the stuff that's heavy on the cut-up, it's hard to read linearly. You know, it's not like you're reading it the way you would read a normal narrative.
That's an understatement.
Yeah. And instead, what I found myself doing, and I would do this actually with James Joyce as well, where you just let the words wash over you, where you're not trying to make a very specific, you know, kind of literal sense out of it. But there's underlying senses that come out, that emerge, where you get sort of impressions. And in that way, it's impressionism. In that kind of way, in that it leaves you with an impression rather than a specific.
Yeah.
But the key with Burroughs is that I would get these impressions, and then there would be specific key words that would come out that would address those impressions. And that would be that's where I think there's a consciousness going on there, rather than just a straight up randomness.
It's right.
Using the randomness, but then trying to draw things or have things emerge, and as they emerge, kind of consciously sort of work them.
Right. Towards the end of his life, he would still use the cut-ups.
Yeah.
But not, you know, for pages and pages on end.
Yeah.
It would be a transition from one scene to another.
Yeah.
Or from one state to another, waking to dreaming,
mm-hmm.
to time travel.
Yeah.
Anything that involved a transformation.
Yeah.
Would go through this cut up process.
Right.
And he refined it and edited it quite a bit.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that it did become part of the narrative.
Yeah. Well, and I was, as I said, coming into the studio as you were doing your piece. I was catching some of that stuff, and
right.
and could sort of see an underlying sensibility to it, just in terms of, you know, the Terence McKenna. There was some
Laura Huxley,
some Anton LaVey, and then on top of that, you were layering various, you know, like the national anthem.
Oh, Canada! The CD I've got that's got about 20 versions of it.
Right, and then folding into that some, you know, strange kind of folk music that I think we determined was from Finland, possibly?
Yeah. And I got the Croatian folk music, CD I bought today for $2 at the St. Vincent.
Nice.
Odd thing to come across in that store.
Yeah, but, I mean, people buy all kinds of stuff, and then, you know, either themselves or relatives down the road go, "What the heck is this?" And yeah. Off it goes. And
that's weird.
Yeah, and that's where you get to, you know, scoop up these crazy things for a buck or less. I guess this comes around to wrapping up what I was saying with the difference in sensibility in terms of what you were doing with the Praying Mantra, which tends to have a little bit more ambience going on, and working with sound texture.
Right. I guess music in that sort of vein has been referred to as isolationist.
Right.
Or isoambient.
Would that be like Soviet France? Would they fall into that sort of?
Yeah. They were a big influence on me.
Right. Ditto.
At one point, I had this one sample that wasn't from Soviet France.
Okay.
But it sounded so characteristic of them that I was playing my one of my tracks, and I thought, is that Soviet France? No, it's me.
Right. I remember seeing, I think it was back when Much Music still did things like City Limits and had some things on the cutting edge.
I'm expecting a phone call. I got to go catch this.
Okay. Well, in the meantime, I will continue on with what I was saying, which is that Soviet France sort of caught my ear eye when I saw some videos on the City Limits show. And there was the VJ was talking about how Soviet France, when they were releasing that particular album, every copy of the cassette, because this is going back to the days of cassettes, pre-CDs, came with a feather, and they gathered these feathers around, I'm not sure whether it was a nuclear testing site or a nuclear reactor, but it was, you know, in the vicinity around this sort of stuff. And it, to me, sort of pointed to the fact that they were not simply making chaotic noise, that there was a kind of underlying sensibility and message kind of going on there. That's something that I think is also an underlying characteristic of things like noise bands and stuff, is that they are, kind of working within a certain, if not a political paradigm, at least there's a certain underlying intentionality that is sort of challenging the presumptions around sound, culture, society.
I missed what you were saying, but I probably agree.
Yeah. Well, I was just saying how Zovia France on one of their albums were including a feather with each of the cassettes.
A feather from the...
Now, was it a nuclear testing zone or was it a power station? Because I seem to remember it was related to nuclear.
I think it was a military installation.
A military installation? Okay, because I know that at the time I was very conscious of some of the nuclear issues at the time.
Yeah.
I was fortunate enough to have a teacher in high school who had an extensive knowledge of the nuclear industry. Now, interestingly enough, he was a supporter of the nuclear industry, but in what he was saying, I pieced together enough to know that I was not a fan of the nuclear industry. And in point of fact, it taught me that these nuclear reactors are not really much more than a big kettle driving a steam turbine, you know, like we're dealing with, you know, industrial age technology on a certain level with these things, but just on a massive scale. And the unfortunate side of it is that the mining, processing, and disposal of this the nuclear stuff is extremely toxic.
Yeah, well, one problem is that metal, like the cooling tubes, the reactor vessel entirely.
Yep.
When this metal is exposed to radiation over a long, long period of time.
Yep.
20 years, 30 years, until a plant is decommissioned.
Yep.
It absorbs the neutron radiation, and it becomes radioactive itself.
Yep.
Not as strongly as uranium or plutonium fuel.
Right.
But enough that you don't want to recycle it and make car parts out of it or something.
And you have to continue to deal with it. I mean, this is one of the things with the, like you say, the actual stuff that's closest to the reaction, after a period of time, those reactors need to be shut down, and then that stuff needs to be babysit for, indefinitely almost, in terms of, the scale of how long it takes.
Well, even the common spent fuel.
Yep.
Or depleted uranium.
Yep.
Which is a misnomer.
Yep.
It's used in armor-piercing shells now.
Yep.
Mostly because uranium is so dense.
Yeah.
It's very heavy.
Yeah. It's a heavy metal.
but this is, it's still radioactive.
Yeah.
There are two main isotopes of uranium.
Mm-hmm.
238, which has a very long half-life.
Yep.
And it's too slow to sustain a reaction.
Right.
And U-235, which is lighter, decays a lot quicker.
Yep.
And provides a lot of energy.
Yeah.
So once there's no 235, there's still the uranium-238.
Right.
Left behind.
Yeah.
Plus all kinds of other fission products, different krypton, beryllium, different elements, some of which are radioactive and some not.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and this is one of the things that I don't think a lot of people realize is that a nuclear reactor has a very finite lifespan. And, it's not like we're building something that's going to keep us in power. Like having power coming from it for generations and generations, because it doesn't last that long.
Well, there's a wave now of building brand new plants.
I know.
There hadn't been a new plant commissioned for over almost 20 years.
Yeah,
I think.
And that's because there was an extensive public education program at a certain point, and people were not happy with it. But there has been a systematic, kind of propaganda campaign. By the nuclear industry to, now convince people that, oh, this is a safe green, quote-unquote, energy. Because they were what they're basically doing is simply looking at, you know, if you're burning coal, then yeah, you've got,
sure,
you know, the equivalent to that in nuclear isn't going to be filling our atmosphere with that sort of waste.
No, we bury it in the ground.
Exactly. Or keep it in big swimming pools.
Yeah, to keep it cool.
To keep it cool. And. Yeah.
But the there's that mine in Nevada.
Yeah.
That is supposed to be the final resting place for American nuclear waste.
Right.
It's gone 300 or 400% over budget.
Right.
And they still don't know if it's going to work.
Work or not. Exactly. And
a fault line through the rock, and it could leak into the water table.
That's right. That's right.
Kill everybody.
Yeah. And these are the sorts of things that just they don't have answers to. And so instead, what they do is underplay it. And you know, quote these massive budgets as, oh, look what we're doing.
Yeah, well, the original promise of nuclear power was that it would be so cheap to produce that,
yeah,
they wouldn't even bother to meter it.
Right.
It'd be free,
yeah,
for everyone.
Yes.
This technological optimism in the 50s.
Yep.
That
just didn't pan out.
I don't know. Maybe we're getting into another age of optimism.
Well, I think that certainly people are reacting to certain, you know, sort of doom and gloom scenarios.
Right.
I think that it is a natural sort of human characteristic to, you know, kind of try to, when you're bombarded by these negative messages, to kind of flip them and become, you know, sort of optimistic in the most...
Well, yeah, it's a matter of self-defense.
Exactly.
You'd go nuts.
Yeah, otherwise. And I think that's been capitalized on. And you know, there's certain people that have a vested interest in...
Public relations...
Yeah.
Came from some of the same theorists as advertising,
yep,
originally.
Yeah.
And they're into psychology up to the eyeballs.
Yep.
Something like 80% of the graduates in psychology go into advertising and public relations.
Yep.
And marketing.
Yep. To the point that, yeah, like everything that you see in a commercial, the color and size of the font to the subtlest background noise is incredibly engineered.
Meticulously plotted out.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
You know, something that's interesting you might not have heard,
mm-hmm,
is that an early guy in advertising theory,
yeah,
and an early founder of public relations was a guy named Ivy Lee.
Oh, yeah.
And he, after he did his work in the United States,
mm-hmm,
he went to work for Hitler. Maybe he just liked a challenge. I don't know.
Yeah.
But he was William Burroughs' uncle.
Oh, right. Yeah, because I do know that with Burroughs, he really, I think part of his thing was that he was reacting against so much of what his family and his roots sort of stood for. And
I don't know. His parents were pretty much a bourgeois family.
Yeah.
They weren't vastly wealthy.
No.
His grandfather invented
the adding machine. Yep.
But he was no businessman.
Yeah.
And he sold out pretty early.
Yeah. Yeah. But it was those sorts of things that I think Burroughs was sort of, you know, kind of sick of.
Right.
And had, you know, could see the undercurrents, which is hence, you know, the naked lunch, right?
It's right.
Like if you could nakedly see your lunch, you would be sick to your stomach. Which I think was a Geisen line. That was it Brian Geisen that came up with that?
I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I think Kerouac invented the name naked lunch.
Okay. It was Kerouac then. Yeah. And I think that this is where they were the first wave, or maybe not the first wave, but the most prominent wave of folks that were saying, hey, wait a minute, there's something wrong here, you know, in the face of this, you know, insane optimism that was going on, coming around to what you're
right.
saying about how in the 50s there was this, you know, techno-utopian kind of dream of this kind of perfect future.
Yeah, which never really did pan out.
No, no. And my suspicion is that the engineers of it didn't really plan on it. panning out. I think that there was some people in there that knew exactly what direction it was heading in. But that might just be me being pessimistic.
People have been so overwhelmed with material possessions, actually a state of luxury compared to former ages.
Yep.
Even if we're poor.
Right.
We've got stereos and stuff, home computers that people couldn't dream of 50 years ago.
Yeah.
But what we're being overwhelmed with even more is just the absolute trivia of the media.
Yeah.
We don't know what's important, or we can't tell figure out what's important from the nonsense.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I think that this is coming around to what culture. And the importance of having alternative voices and creating spaces that sort of distract from the distraction.
Yeah. Well, culture has been moving towards the spectacle and beyond for a long time now.
Yeah.
And away from participation.
Yeah. Yeah. And that is the thing, is that if you go back to a lot of folk culture it was fully participatory, you know, even square dancing, you know, as a old classic example of everyone joining in and feeling, you know, connected with their neighbors and friends and on that local level. And I think it's where myself I've expressed in the past how I see local cultural development is as important as local farming, and both of those things are things that are, you know, subpar right now, and really in some ways I feel like they're vital for our future.
Yeah.
And it's something that I would like to encourage everybody to help support. Yeah, they're very parallel.
We have to make our own culture if we want to make it meaningful to us.
That's right. Yeah. And in past episodes, last season, we'd talked about, you know, the kind of lowest common denominator culture and how unhealthy it is. Where, you know, there are these people that we stare at and feed off of their every, you know, kind of trivial movement, as you were saying, you know, like we know these celebrities, their intimate details of their personal life, and I mean, how does that relate to our day-to-day life?
We're never going to meet these people. They're never going to be our friends.
No.
Or our family.
No. And they're very disconnected from our immediate reality, but they take precedent over our immediate reality, unfortunately.
It takes up so much time that people don't have time to consider anything important politically.
Yeah. And in point of fact, I've talked to a number of people who, you know, when you get them talking or talk to them about those sort of, you know, quote unquote relevant things in their immediate life, they become quite sort of defensive.
Yeah. And sometimes insist that they actually are well-informed because they watch the news.
Yeah, 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 because they know the latest celebrity gossip, and that to them is being, you know, a participant in culture.
In touch with the world.
Yeah. Oy. But, I mean, this is you know, kind of the wall we're up against, and, you know, first step is identifying.
Yeah. Well, I started out in radio when I was in high school, and that I think that gave me something of a defense against popular culture.
Right.
Because I had to do research here to find stuff that was relevant to my show, to my stated aims, and I didn't have time to listen to pop music radio.
Right.
Or pop culture in general, which is not pop culture.
All right.
Pop culture is like popular, made by the populace.
Yeah.
And what we have surrounding us right now is corporate culture.
Right. Yes. That has been made popular, but not through its own merit in terms of connection with people's lives, but rather...
No, just because they got the biggest broadcasters.
That's right. And I think that this comes around to one of the things that's happening right now with the explosion of internet and diversified media. And I do have the feeling that... the recording industry is talking about how, you know, file sharing and stuff like that is, you know, directly attacking their bottom line.
Right.
But I think that, yes, it is, but it's not because people are downloading their stuff, but rather people are being exposed to a much more diverse range of culture.
The music you'll hear on a commercial station is just such a tiny fraction of the kind of music that's being made.
Yeah, exactly. And people are seeking out stuff that speaks to them more and feels more relevant. And because we saw through the 90s a rise in indie labels and stuff, which of course the larger labels and stuff tried to go around buying up. And
they did in a lot of cases.